You know, Brother Jay, when I think of February, I think of the British Isles.
Do you now?
I do. I think of Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and Edgar Wright and all of the wonderful cast of characters that we'll meet in the four movies, or sorry, the three movies, the Cornetto trilogy, the Blood and Ice Cream trilogy, Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End.
The Village Green Preservation Society. God save the duck, Bonneville and variety.
Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is true.
Why? If it ain't a clown. You know, I never found clowns that funny myself.
And they're sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
Tonight we have the second in the Cornetto trilogy, 2007's Hot Fuzz, written by Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright, directed by Edgar Wright, and starring Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Now, this is the first time you've seen this movie, and what did you think, just overall?
It was okay. It wasn't as good as Shaun of the Dead, and I was having a hard time wrapping my head around it because I wasn't sure where it was going. And so I tried to just kind of go with it, because at first it was just kind of this goofy comedy, and then it turned into a slasher film. So it was kind of really over the top, I realized, but it was also kind of gratuitously over the top in a way that I found a little off-putting.
Well, they literally went through Roger Ebert's book of action movie cliches so they could get all of them into this movie.
Well, that's hilarious.
Yeah, so this was...
That was a goal? Well, that makes sense. I got very early on that everybody's name was their profession.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, so I thought that was, you know, I chuckled at that every time I got somebody else's, you know. I thought it was funny, but in the same vein of, you know, kind of Shaun of the Dead, you know, the names all meant something, so.
Oh, yeah, and the... Well, first, we'll even begin before we start talking about the movie. We'll get into the trivia just to start with. Edgar Wright wanted to name the movie Hot Fuzz, HOTTFUZZ, but Simon Pegg said, no, I'm going to have to explain two T's in hot every single time I talk about this movie. And he's right. So they left it the traditional spelling.
Okay. I did really... really love that Timothy Dalton was the villain.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. And I recognized him like off the bat. I'm like, oh my God, it's Timothy Dalton.
It turns out
with the sunglasses. Before I ever pulled the sunglasses off, I knew it was Timothy Dalton.
Well, they wrote the part with him in mind.
That's awesome.
And so we're delighted when he actually did it.
I hope that he had as much fun and was as good a guy as he seemed to be on film, because this was a movie where it looked to me, and I didn't take any notes really, because this isn't really a note movie. There wasn't really anything of note to take, in my opinion. And you've seen it more than once, so you may have different than me. But to me, I was like, there wasn't really anything to write down. But to me, it looked like they had a good time making the movie, which was kind of hilarious. So,
well, let me just clue you a little bit on Timothy Dalton. Not only was he a good guy, like he came in and there's a word for it that I'm not going to be able to pull, but you know, when you do the two shot where you have cameras over the shoulder of somebody and
the line reading.
Yeah. Well, you don't need both actors in the same room for that kind of thing. But
right. And sometimes the line reading, the over the shoulder isn't even read by the actor who was on the other side.
Well, that's what I mean. The actor on the other side doesn't have to be there.
Right.
But Timothy Dalton showed up for all of that. He was definitely on the other side of all those conversations, even though he wasn't on screen at all.
It's funny you mentioned that. I just finished the audiobook, the Kevin Pollak book, How I Slept My Way to the Middle.
And what'd you think?
It's a great book. It's narrated by him, which is also great. He's got some great stories, and he talks about all about like working with people and
like, so, does he spill dirt?
Oh yeah.
Oh, excellent. Well, then it's going to go on the top of my list.
Yeah. He's got some, and I don't want to spoil all it for you. But the Aunt Bessie joke that I sent you on text was from him.
His Aunt Bessie
was apparently like, you know, does this dress make me look fat? And Kevin's response was like, you know what makes you look fat? Vision. The fact that we can see you. Which is very funny. But apparently, something else he discovered, since we're already off the rails and off tangent already, Barry Levinson was a stand-up comedian. So that's why he and Mel Brooks and all of those people would hang out together, is because they were, you know, they would do comedy together.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. And so that's kind of some good, but there's a lot of stories in there. And he talks about Tom Cruise a lot because he and Tom Cruise became really good friends. And so it's kind of interesting because he's like, look, I know Tom Cruise is a Scientologist, but he's actually the sweetest, geekiest, nerdiest guy you could meet. And so the Scientology is just part of him. The enthusiasm that you see where he's like jumping on the couch is just because he's like a teenager and doesn't ever rein in his enthusiasm.
Well, and I have never heard anybody say anything bad about Tom Cruise who's ever worked with him. I mean, right. The only thing they have to say as far as being like intense is that apparently he gives, if he comes in and says hello to you, he gives you his full attention.
Right.
Which is it's unexpected in anybody, let alone somebody who you may be a little iffy about because he's a superstar.
Well, and as Kevin was saying in the book, and I won't give too much away, because it is a great listen. It really does. It really was riveting. I listened to it in a single day this weekend, where I started on Friday and on Saturday. He talks about, you know, most actors, they'll get the call to come to set from the production crew, and they'll take anywhere from, you know, 5 minutes to half an hour to an hour to show up, which is why the show producers have to know, like, if I call Bruce Willis to the set, I know that if I tell him we're ready for him, he'll be here in a half an hour. If I tell Gina Davis we're ready, she'll take 15 minutes. If I tell, you know, Angelica Houston, she'll be here in 20 minutes. So they kind of coordinate all that when they have big films with lots of actors. When they call Tom Cruise, Tom Cruise is there within 60 seconds. He's ready to go. He's there and he's on. So they talk about the whole process of like A Few Good Men and the whole nine yards, and like there's just so much stuff going on, and there's a lot of anecdotes written in the book which is a great writing device, where he's got, and now for Kevin Pollak, enough about me, Steve Martin on Kevin Pollak. And so there's all these little, like, he's gotten other people to do some quotes for him.
Oh, get out of town. So you have like actual, yeah. Steve Martin?
No, not an, I mean, it's Steve Martin. It's not read in the audiobook. In the book, it's, I mean, the note is written by Steve Martin for Kevin Pollak's book, but Kevin Pollak reads all of it. There's nobody else.
Because, you know, does he get an opportunity to use all his impressions? Because he's a brilliant impressionist.
Yes, he uses tons of impressions.
Yeah, well, that's good because he's very good at it.
Yeah, that's how he started.
Well, in fact,
you find out chapter one.
Peter Falk, because he can do the eye thing. But most people's impression of Christopher Walken comes from Kevin Pollak's impression of Christopher Walken.
Yeah, and so there's some great stories, especially because he goes into Johnny Carson, and I think you and I have discussed how much I love Johnny Carson. So it was great to hear those stories because it just makes me, you know, I get those memories too. It's definitely a positive read.
Have you heard It's a Good Thing You're Funny by Philip Rosenthal?
No.
Philip Rosenthal is the showrunner for Everybody Loves Raymond. And it's very similar as far as like a kind of a Hollywood memoir. But it not only is it great because he has lots of stories, fun stories about what worked and what didn't work with Everybody Loves Raymond, but also other things he worked on. Plus, you know, he won like several awards or spoke at several award shows or award ceremonies. And he actually drops audio of the ceremony into the audiobook. So he doesn't have to just read a speech he actually gave. He just plays the speech, which is pretty fun.
That's interesting.
And it gave me a lot more respect for Everybody Loves Raymond, the show itself. Because it goes into why that show worked when maybe other shows don't.
Huh. Well, so, I was never a huge fan.
Well, I would suggest it maybe anyway. Although, again, it's, you know, I just got a lot out of it as far as learning behind the scenes. Like, I had never even heard or knew what the term showrunner meant. I mean, he's basically the producers of the whole show. But he doesn't, like, direct individual episodes necessarily. Anyway, it's very interesting. Okay, so are we going to talk about this movie?
Yeah, I don't know where we left off.
We left off at the beginning. We have yet to even talk about the plot of this movie. So, the movie opens, and we're introduced to Constable Nicholas Angel.
Sergeant Nicholas Angel. Expert in hand-to-hand combat. Armed response. And high-speed pursuit. He was so good, they reassigned him.
Right. You've been making us all look bad. There's one thing you haven't taken into account, and that's what the team is going to make of this.
Statistically, Sanford is the safest village in the country.
Now, this big city cop.
You ever fired two guns whilst jumping through the air?
No.
You ever fired one gun whilst jumping through the air?
No.
Must learn.
Is it true that there is a place in a man's head that if you shoot it, it will blow up?
How to think small.
Morning for Swan's Escape.
The Swan's Escape.
Can you describe it to me?
About 2 foot tall.
Yep.
Long, slender neck.
That's just gonna scare it.
But in a place where not much goes on.
Watch this.
Ta-da! A whole lot is about to go down.
Three people have died in a week.
Accidents happen all the time. What makes you think it was murder?
There hasn't been a murder in 20 years.
You're saying this wasn't an accident?
Not everyone's a murdering psychopath. It's high time you realize that. You and your monkey.
Did he mean me or that?
Have you ever wondered why the crime rate is so low, and yet the accident rate, it's so high?
I'm
gonna bust this thing wide open.
From the guys who watched every action movie ever made and created Shaun of the Dead.
You never taken a shortcut before?
Heat is on.
Here come the fuzz.
Go, go, go.
You gotta call. The fuzz.
Gunfights, car chases.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Hot fuzz.
Got a mustache.
I know.
According to the certificates, he received 9 commendations, and their awards for Operation Shakedown, Crackdown, Showdown, and Takedown, among them, as seen on the wall as they flash past them. And let's see, in the very opening scene, we have 2 Oscar Award winners. We have Peter Jackson dressed up like Santa, stabbing Nicholas Angel in the hand.
Which I did laugh out loud at.
And we have his ex-girlfriend, who he goes to say goodbye to because he's being shuffled off to a quiet village. And that's played all completely in hazmat gear, so you can't see her face, but it's played by Kate Blanchett, which is also funny. But, Officer or Constable, you know, PC Nicholas Angel, is being promoted to sergeant. And, unfortunately, he's such a super cop that he's making the rest of the cops at the Metropolitan Police Service look bad. So he's being sent from London out toward Sanford, Gloucestershire. And the people that send him out are, Martin Freeman plays the Met Sergeant, and Bill Nighy is the Chief Inspector of the Met. And while he is admired for his police ability, he's not exactly liked.
No.
He doesn't have any personality. He is a by-the-book cop through and through.
Well, and as they explain to him, you know, he's making them all look bad. Because, you know, he's doing all this great stuff, and they're not up to his standard.
Exactly. So we take a quick trip to see Janine, Kate Blanchett, and he's like, I'm being transferred. But she's already seeing somebody else anyway, so it's not a big deal. By the way, that is the last of the romantic interest in this movie. This is not a relationship story of a romance, kind of like Shaun of the Dead was. This is a buddy movie.
Yeah, this isn't a redemption movie. This is a finding yourself movie.
Yeah. So Sergeant Angel gets sent out to Sanford, and he checks into a hotel and has a little banter with the crossword puzzling desk clerk. And he goes to the local pub where he meets the publicans Roy and Mary Porter and a group of underage drinkers. And then this drunk guy that he immediately arrests for drunk driving. And then on the way to march him to the station as a drunk driver, he encounters the kids that he kicked out of the pub and takes them in for disorderly conduct. And presents them all at the police station the day before he's supposed to even start working. Much to the astonishment of the sergeant of the watch or whatever, who's like, you know, really, this, you really want to arrest everybody? It's going to be a lot of paperwork. But Nicholas Angel is all about police work, and that means he's all about paperwork. So we find out that the guy he arrested for drunk driving is actually his new partner, PC Danny Butterman, Nick Frost, and that the inspector, the boss of everybody, is Frank Butterman, who's played by Jim Broadbent, Oscar winner, and he's Danny's father. And we learn that, you know, the few crimes in the village are rarely punished. This is noted for winning, like, Village of the Year 5 times in a row or something.
Yes. There's a big point of contention because, you know, they're Village of the Year. And then, of course, they make the point when he's first driving to the town, they see the sign for the model village on the signpost. But, you know, it also, you very quickly realize that the reason that there's no crime in the town is not because there's no crime, but it's that they don't bother to report any of it because the police just kind of like, meh.
Yeah. It seems a very, like, laissez-faire attitude they take toward crime, which does not fit well with Nicholas Angel.
Now, he's a very black and white by the book guy.
Yes. He's not fun at all. But he goes out jogging, and as he's jogging through the little town, we have the Kinks Village Green plays, which is pretty funny. And this is where we meet Simon Skinner, whose fellow jogger, played by Timothy Dalton. And he is a slasher of prices, whose discounts are criminal at his grocery store. And Timothy Dalton is chewing up the scenery pretty well, but yeah, he's having a good time. Later we're going to talk about, or at some point we'll talk about the, like there's some fighting and some car chase scenes. And Timothy Dalton said he had more fun on this film than he did on the Bond films, as far as car chase and gunfight.
And it was great. I mean, God bless Timothy Dalton. Because, you know, he was okay as James Bond, but this he was great in this movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's you know more about Bond than I do, but it seems like he would have been a better Bond with better scripts.
Maybe. I guess it depends. Maybe. If he had been handed maybe Casino Royale, maybe, but I would put it to you that almost any of the Bonds would have been a better Bond in Casino Royale than they were in the previous movies.
Well, do you think Timothy Dalton was just sort of a lesser Bond? Like, was he better or worse than, say, Pierce Brosnan?
I think Pierce Brosnan was better. Pierce Brosnan had a different swagger. Timothy Dalton wasn't bad. He wasn't my favorite.
He just
Pierce Brosnan is higher up to me. And of course, you know, Daniel Craig is pretty damn good. Roger Moore, you know, was probably my least favorite except for, George Lazenby and, you know, on Her Majesty's Secret Service. So, he was probably the worst, but that's also only gauging him on one movie that was really kind of a anomaly Bond movie because it was really kind of...
It was the Bond love story.
It was a wonky film, so it just didn't fit. And the Roger Moore years were campy, and so Roger Moore did a good job with what he had, but it was also, you know, the campy years. So you had to take it in the spirit that it was. Sean Connery was a good Bond because it was, you know, it was the opening of the series. But, you know, again, he was good. He was better than Roger Moore, but the writing was different. So it's hard to gauge them in a kind of a, there's not really a level playing field. It's not really apples to apples. But I still stand by that right now. Daniel Craig is probably the best so far. I'm cautiously optimistic that if they cast, I just forgot his name.
Idris Elba?
Yes. If they cast him as the next Bond, I think he will be a fantastic choice.
Oh yeah. Well, I can't wait. Although there's still at least another Daniel Craig movie, right?
If they don't buy off his contract. There's always talk that they might not renew Daniel Craig because of his hair and his body. So,
but aren't they already making the Spectre movie?
Oh, are they? I didn't know it wasn't gone into production yet.
I think it's pretty close, if not already.
No, they might already be making it.
So, back to Timothy Dalton as Simon Skinner. He's a great Simon Skinner. We can agree on that.
Yeah, but I think, and I don't know about you, but again, since the first time I saw this movie was last night. I knew instantly he was the villain. You could tell that he was the bad guy.
Well, he's got all those fun villain lines.
Yeah.
And he sets off Angel's cop radar, figuratively speaking. So, and then we go back to the station where we meet the rest of the gang. And that's the Andes, Detective Sergeant Andy Wainwright, played by Patty Considine. And Detective Constable Andy Cartwright, played by Rafe Spall. And they are the typical detectives in mustaches who are, they're constantly smoking and wearing sunglasses and having their mustaches. And then we have Sergeant Tony Fisher, Kevin Eldon, who is notable for wearing glasses and having big sideburns. We have...
reminds me of Dwight from The Office.
Yes, a little bit. Absolutely. We have PC Bob Walker, Carl Johnson, Mumbles. We have PC Doris Thatcher, Olivia Colman, who's the saucy PC. And we have, we meet Tom Weaver, Edward Woodward, who's the head of the Neighborhood Watch Alliance, NWA.
Yeah, which I laughed out loud.
Oh, yeah. Well, not only is it NWA, but Edward Woodward, I mean, from The Equalizer?
Yeah.
Amazing. And, of course, the scourge of the town at the moment, because they have all the CCTV that the Neighborhood Watch watches, is the living statue. And I just love the living statue. You know, if we don't crack down on these clowns, we'll be up to our balls and jugglers.
Well, and, you know, in Portland, we have a living statue.
Because do you allow busking on the streets?
I'm sorry, we allow what?
Busking, like performing for money?
It's tolerated. He's silver. He's all silver, and he stands down usually by the Pioneer Square Mall. And when I first moved here, I didn't realize that he was a living, breathing person. I just thought he was a statue.
So he got you?
Oh, yeah, until I saw him move, and then I freaked the fuck out.
So you're in the camp where living statues are creepy?
Well, I wouldn't say they're creepy. It startled me because I thought it wasn't real, and then it was. And so, you know, had I realized all along he was alive, it wouldn't have scared me. But instead, nope, it scared me.
Yeah. Well. And you have the flaming bagpiper, right?
The unipiper. Yeah. The flaming bagpiper on the unicycle.
Yeah.
We left out the most important part, the unicycle.
Well, of course, because you got to be mobile with those flaming bagpipes.
He's hilarious.
Oh, I'm sure he is. Very talented, too.
You've heard him, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's probably a certifiable nut job, too.
Well, it's Portland.
Yeah, I'm sorry. He's probably a mental health consumer, too. But, you know, then again, Spoon Man, right?
Yeah, well, that's Seattle.
Yeah, well, I know, but, you know, as far as buskers go. Anyway. Well,
yeah.
So, Danny, by the way, Danny is very impressed with Nicholas Angel and pesters him with questions, which, you know, Nick Frost, he's, you know, I said that that Ed from Shaun of the Dead was, you know, a kind of a sweet character, like, simple. I mean, he was rude and crude, but he was just, he wasn't malevolent. He was completely just simple. But Danny Butterman also, he's just sweet. He's just enthusiastic.
Yeah.
You know?
He's really kind of happy-go-lucky.
Yeah, and you know, he doesn't, unlike Nicholas Angel, who has wanted to be a police officer for a very long time, you know, Danny is just, it's just like a job that his dad works at too, you know, and he's just impressed with, you know, asking the questions of, have you ever fired two guns whilst jumping through the air? Then Angel goes to the NWA meeting, and where you meet school teacher Amanda Paver, horticulturist Leslie Tiller, farmer James Reaper, Reverend Shooter, and Dr. Robin Hatcher. Again, all these names. And then Angel has to go talk to the school kids, and that's where we meet reporter-editor Tim Messenger, played by Adam Buxton. And Nicholas Angel doesn't really like his new job. He's irritated by the whole thing. And he kind of gets to his, it comes to a head when he gets a call from a guy who's reporting that a swan has escaped. And he's like, sure, a swan has escaped. And then,
well, he's ordered to go investigate the swan by the chief.
Well, but the guy who calls, he asks for his name. And he says, Peter Ian Staker, P.I. Staker, Piss Taker. He's like, rah! And then that's when the chief comes and tells him, no, you have to go take this report. And that's, who is Piss Taker?
Cokington, right?
Stephen Merchant.
Oh.
Yeah, no, that would be great if it was Carl Pilkington. But no, Stephen Merchant, a writer of The Office and Extras with Ricky Gervais.
Because I always see him on with Ricky Gervais on Idiot Abroad.
Yes. Yeah. Carl is the idiot, and Stephen and Ricky are the guys.
I always get the names confused. Yeah. It's just a great show, by the way.
Well, I loved Ricky Gervais's podcast. A lot of it was really silly, but I was wearing the sleep mask at night, but listening to the podcast, I would like have trouble breathing because I was laughing so hard in bed.
Ricky Gervais has infectious laughter.
Well, and that's the thing, is infectious laughter. And then the fact that Carl is just so simple, and it just, I don't know whether it was a put on or whatever, but he just sounded so genuine about things, like he thought a bee had a heart attack. And for some reason, you know, within the context of the show, a bee having a heart attack was hysterical.
Some of the Idiot Abroad stuff I have watched repeatedly, and I laugh myself silly every time. It's just so funny. And so I don't know if it's a put-up job or not, but I don't care. But some of the things where they had to ride camels out into the middle of the desert, and he's sleeping in a rock cave.
Well, and of course, the best thing about Carl is he's whinging the entire way.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the funnier things of the podcast is when they were going to, Ricky was going to buy a goat for an African village for Christmas through one of the services, you know.
And, Pepper International.
Yeah, and Carl's like, who wants to open a goat on Christmas? And it was just, again, it's hard to explain how funny that was in the context of the show. Okay, so back to this movie. So we have an escaped swan as part of the main characters in this little adventure. And then we meet Michael Armstrong, Lurch, played by Rory McCann, who is probably best known these days as the Hound from Game of Thrones. And he has the best lines in this movie. Yarb.
That's where I recognized him from.
Yeah, he's the Hound.
Oh my God.
So after visiting Skinner in the story, we have her pursuit as a shoplifter, but of course Skinner refuses to prosecute, which irritates Nick to no end. And then Danny and Nicholas are in the cop car running radar and pull over two amateur actors, Martin Blower and Eve Draper. And that's where we learn that the notebook is the greatest tool a police officer has. By the way, Danny's flip book is indeed extraordinary.
It was pretty awesome.
So that's when this movie, it turns into something a little bit different, because it's all like sort of slapstick, sort of fish out of water fun at this point. But the one thing about the Edgar Wright movies is that when there's a gory scene, they go full gore. The actors, Blower and Draper, are murdered by this hooded assailant who cuts off their heads and makes it look like a traffic accident. I'm sorry, traffic collision. And, you know, they showed, like, severed heads in the road, which is, you know, gross enough. And, of course, as they blocked off the road, Skinner drives by, and he's making villain-type quips as his car stereo is playing the Dire Straits' Romeo and Juliet, because that's what these actors were playing. So Angel is not convinced that this is an accident. Thinks maybe there's something up, because he doesn't like Skinner. Then we get a nice scene where we go out and confiscate a shed full of unlicensed firearms, including a mine, a naval mine. And the officer, the officer mumbles, is pretty funny.
No, that whole sequence is pretty funny. And the mine, yeah, and I'm sure it was funnier if you're a member of the UK where, you know, guns are not legal. I mean, handguns aren't legal. You know, hunting rifles are. When, you know, he's got this entire, you know, he could arm an entire brigade.
Oh, yeah. It's a full modern armory. And then this naval mine also right in the middle. Which also explains then how we get a bunch of firearms later in the movie. Except, you know, like I said before, that every farmer and their mother has a gun out in the villages. But now we have some bigger armament that will come in handy later. But then they go to the pub. Danny and Nicholas go to the pub, and Danny asks him why he wanted to be a police officer. And he tells a story about, you know, he always wanted to be one, except for that time in 1979 when he wanted to be Kermit the Frog. And this is when the movie gets a little sweet, because, you know, they finally bond. And
so at one point, I actually thought they were going to get it on.
Well, yeah, this is kind of a love story between Nicholas and Danny.
They really felt that way.
So they're getting a little drunk as well, and they have to escort businessman George Merchant. He's the refrigerator magnate. They escort him home and then leave him there. And as they're walking back and they pass Danny's house, and Danny's like, oh, why don't you come in for a beer? So they sit on the couch and they kind of talk about how Nicholas's problem is he can't switch off his melon. He can't stop being a cop. And Danny offers a solution. So they start watching action movies, specifically Bad Boys 2 and Point Break.
Which are two awful movies.
Well, it's funny. I remember Bad Boys 2 a little bit. I mean, it's not super memorable. I've never seen Point Break.
No, it was a terrible movie.
Oh, people love it. But again, it's to me, it was like, why would I want to go see a Keanu Reeves, Patrick Swayze movie?
Now, careful.
Well, that's the thing. No, I'm just saying, you know. Then, after as they're watching the movie, we find out that after they left Mr. Merchant in the house, the hooded bad guy goes into the house and turns on the gas and also throws some bacon in a pan and some beans, like he's making a little fry of breakfast for himself, and blows up the house, like levels this house. So they're called to investigate that. And Skinner drives by with the song Fire playing in his car at this time. And the police department labels the death as another accident. So Angel's not satisfied with that. And they have to go to a picnic for saving the church roof. And Angel is contacted by Tim Messenger, of course, the editor of the Sanford Citizen paper, saying that he's got information on Skinner. So Angel's happy to talk to him about that. And they're going to meet Messenger at 3 p.m. by the church. In the meantime, Angel wins Danny a big monkey at the air rifle stand at the big picnic. Kind of a carnival thing.
It was actually kind of a really sweet scene.
Oh, it is. Yeah, all the interaction. I mean, like, he wins Danny the big monkey. Again, Danny's super impressed. But then Nicholas has to go meet with Tim Messenger, And he gets there just a little bit late because Tim Messenger gets hit in the head by a piece of the roof that is pushed off by the killer in a very graphic scene.
In the most over-the-top kind of gruesome, it is almost Monty Python-esque.
Oh, yeah. It is execution. Way over, literal execution is way over the top. But funny. I'm sure in the theater you'd be like having to catch your breath because you'd be laughing so hard.
Oh, I did a semi-Pulp Fiction.
Oh, yeah. Because you just don't expect it.
It was so over the top that I was like, I sucked in not all of the air in the room, but I sucked in about half of the air in the room. Because I was like, okay, that was over the top.
Again, it's seen as just a terrible accident. But no, he says, look, this is actually a murder. So the chief inspector is like, okay, I guess it's a crime scene. So he and Danny get to sit out in the rain. And it's a fun little thing because Danny is dressed up like as a sort of a cowboy. And when they're in the rain, there's that little plastic hood that goes over the policeman's cap of Nicholas. And Danny's got the same little hood over his little cowboy hat.
Yeah, it was pretty cute.
Yeah, it's fun. So then Angel has some harsh words for Danny, like lectures him about, you know, not paying attention. And so Danny, like, leaves, not feeling very good. In fact, Angel comes back to his hotel room to find that Danny has left the big monkey that he won for him. But that's when we have a little montage of Angel looking through all the newspapers, going to the newspaper morgue and looking through every single newspaper to try to put all these things together. And he comes back the next day and invites Danny to go, you know, says, come on, partner, we're going to investigate these murders. And Danny's, again, happy to be on the case with him. And they have so much fun looking for, you know, trying to put pieces together.
Because he's really at this point, you know, he's the big brother. They're like brothers, really.
Oh, and he's just, Danny is like happy to have a friend, you know?
Yeah, because he's clearly lived in this little village his whole life, you know, and the village is clearly, you know, this backwater, you know, small kind of spot on the map. And he doesn't have any real push or drive to leave the city because it's all he's known, and his dad's still there and his mom died there, and so he's happy to have a buddy who's come into his environment, who's kind of, you know, mixing it up and actually doing what he considers to be something real police work.
And he's like a superhero.
Yeah, he's really an idol.
Yeah, so much so that they investigate these crimes, and at the end of the day, they take all the notes back to the station, and Danny's still not really convinced that it wasn't all just a series of accidents. But they're interrupted by a fire in the station, the fire being the candles on Danny's birthday cake. He was so happy to be hanging out with Nicholas that he didn't even bother to tell Nicholas it was his birthday. And Nicholas is so touched by this, he goes to the florist, Leslie Tiller, to buy Danny a Japanese peace lily. Because they had this conversation about how Danny needs a plant, blah, blah, blah. And that's when the florist gets stabbed in the neck with the pruning shears. And also a kind of a fun over-the-top scene. And Angel has to go and pursue the bad guy. But the bad guy, of course, eludes him still. And this is where Nicholas Angel flips his chicken. He has now seen a murder with his own eyes, and still they're saying, no, it was maybe an accident. And they're kind of humoring him when he's suggesting that he knows Skinner was involved. So they all go down to Skinner's grocery store, and he lays out this whole thing. Unfortunately, Skinner's got a complete alibi and is not injured like the guy who ran from the Tiller's murder. So Angel's theory is kind of out the window. But that's when they're going to get a cornetto from the corner shop, they realize that, no, it may not be one killer. It could be multiple killers. So he brings the idea to Danny's dad, Frank. But, the previous sergeant that was in there, like, had a nervous breakdown and just left. So that's where the inspector says, you know, maybe you need to sleep on this idea. You're kind of high-strung right now.
You're kind of turning out like the last guy.
Yeah. And he's very fatherly about the whole thing. And like, you know, young man, you need to just, you know, need to calm down and we'll deal with this all. But when he returns to his hotel room, he's attacked by a cloaked figure. And that's another thing about this movie that this movie actually gets right is the fight scenes are pretty well choreographed.
Yeah.
You know, they're sort of goofy and over the top a little bit, but there's real action in this. That's where it turns out it's Michael Armstrong, Yarb, that's sent to attack Angel. And that's when he, after he knocks Michael unconscious, he listens to the radio and realizes that Skinner is back at the village castle. And he's going to go and blow this thing wide open. And that's when we find out that there's not just one killer, but everybody is involved. All the NWA members are all murderers. And they want this perfect little village, and they're going to... Anybody who gets in the way of their perfect village is going to be murdered. Including the kids that were brought in on the nuisance charge, and the living statue. Now, Danny thinks his mom died from a motor vehicle collision, but did she really commit suicide?
Maybe. I got the impression she was trying to leave.
Well, something, but like a group of gypsy travelers came in and maybe she like lost the first like horticultural trophy or I don't know, something. I don't know. It's in the notes here. Not from me, from the Wikipedia thing, that Frank started to murder in the name of his wife, who committed suicide. But anyway, so they spill all the beans to Angel, and they come after him to take care of Angel, but he runs, and that's where he falls into a crypt. He falls into a crypt and discovers like skeletons of the people that they disposed of, including his predecessor sergeant, the living statue. Pretty much everybody who's been arrested ever for anything. And the gypsy travelers as well. So he gets out into the open, but he is cornered and stabbed by Danny. And Danny takes him out of town, having faked his death. And tells him to get out of the village. And Danny doesn't seem to know anything about any murders, doesn't know anything about any skeletons. And he doesn't believe his father is Judge Judy and executioner. But this is where the movie sort of kicks into its final high gear. As Angel is traveling back to London, he stops at a store and sees a row of action movies and decides to buy himself some sunglasses and some spray paint and get himself the toothpick and head back into town. Much like kinda Clint hilarious. Eastwood's Man with No Name ends up riding into town on a white horse, literally goes in and checks out a bunch of the weapons from the evidence room. By the way, the code on the evidence room,
999,
which is the equivalent to 911.
Yes.
And that's when we have the final showdown. Well, sort of. The main set piece of violence is when Nicholas rides into town on the horse with his guns and all of the NWA in the village come out, and they turn out to be heavily armed themselves.
He's going to confront a heavily armed NWA.
Yes.
So as it says, Danny's mother loved Sanford and worked so hard to make it the best village, but the day the judges came in, the gypsy family showed up, and they lost. Danny's mother went insane and killed herself.
Ah, okay, there we go. So that's what set Frank, Danny's dad, off. Anyway, yeah, so they end up having this dramatic firefight where Angel and then finally Danny and Angel both end up wounding but not killing really any of the NWA members, but they take him out.
Well, they never really shoot anybody. They shoot objects that hit people, but I don't think they ever actually shoot a person.
I don't think Nicholas does, although Danny shoots the priest in the shoulder, I think. Yeah, I think you're right, though. I don't think Nicholas actually shoots anybody directly. Yeah, but right. One of the funnier scenes is when that a little lady on the bicycle comes.
She pulls out the basket and her thermos and the guns are all in there.
Yeah, and she's got two handguns, you know, a handgun in either hand, kind of. Anyway, look, Ma, no hands as she's shooting away. But she gets doored by Danny's car, which is awesome. So I guess, you know, bicyclists getting doored by a car is not all that funny. People die all the time, apparently, in big cities. But in this case, it was hilarious. So Then they have the scene where they end up in a vehicle pursuit between Skinner and Frank and Danny and Angel, and they capture the swan en route. And at the end, we have Skinner and Angel having hand-to-hand combat in the miniature village. And this movie is going to end on a gross note. Because during the fight, Skinner slips and impales his jaw on the miniature cathedral spire.
This is hilarious.
Oh, yeah, it's so gross. In fact, my daughter happened to see this scene. It was on my computer at the time. And she's like, is that fake? I'm like, yes, it's quite fake. Yeah. And then I had to explain to her how they make fake blood. But, yeah. So you have, and then, of course, Frank leaves in Angel's car, but there's the swan in Angel's car, and the swan pecks him and apparently breaks his arm. They mentioned earlier that a swan can break a man's arm. So
I just assumed he broke his arm hitting the tree.
No, it was implied that the swan did it. So the movie ends with London's chief inspector arrives and asks him to return to his old post, but Angel declines. And while he and his colleagues are processing paperwork, Tom Weaver, the NWA member who works at the station, attempts to shoot Angel with an antique blunderbuss. But Danny jumps in front of the shot, and then Angel hits Weaver with a waste bin, sends him into the mine, which then blows up the entire station. And we think for a moment that Danny has been killed. But it flashes to Danny having survived. A year later, they've received their promotions, and Angel is now promoted to inspector, and Danny is the sergeant. The end. By the way, this police department has way more sergeants than actual constables. Which is pretty funny. By the way, the whole big gunfight happened the day where the best kept village competition judges were in town.
And yeah, so I'm pretty sure they get crossed off the list.
Yes, yes. There's one guy and two women who were judges. And the two women are Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg's mothers. And let's see. Yeah, they intentionally did cliches from from L.A. Confidential, Mad Max, Lethal Weapon, Man on Fire, Bad Boys, Chinatown. They use things like having a character wake up in a dark hotel room and flick on the light switch without having to fumble for it. Having a shot of the median lines on the road from a moving camera. And having the genial person in charge actually be the bad guy, which is where Frank Butterman is the bad guy. Much like James Cromwell in L.A. Confidential. So, that's Hot Fuzz. Frankly, I think I like this the second time I saw it better than the first time. I don't think it's quite as good as a movie as Shaun of the Dead. But I still think it's well worth watching.
Yeah, no, it was a good movie. I mean, it was it chewed through the scenery pretty fast, and it I think the paradigm shift that happened is what threw me off. And when I say that, I mean, it was started as one kind of movie and then changed into a different kind of movie. And I think that's where it lost me. If it had been this kind of over the top, you know, slasher movie film from the beginning, I think I would have liked that a lot more, but because it changed moods, it just kind of, it felt like two movies.
Would you rather have had the violence be a little more, like, not quite so graphic? Like, more slapstick?
Maybe. Or if they didn't, but they did in Shaun of the Dead, where there was murder from the beginning of the movie, so that there was a comedy on top of a murder slasher film, if you will. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess I can see that. Well, there's that. I mean, Santa does stab him in the hand with the knife.
Yeah, but that's incidental,
I suppose.
But yeah, no, it wasn't a terrible movie. I mean, I liked it. I'll go back and rewatch it because I had the DVD with all the special features. I didn't have a chance to go through those, but I'll revisit it. So you should, if you haven't seen it, I recommend it. It's a good thing.
So next week will be part 3 of the Cornetto trilogy, The World's End, which I have never seen. Have you?
Nope.
Oh, excellent. So hopefully we'll have fun stuff to talk about.
Yeah, hopefully we don't hate it.
Yeah, well, if we hate it, we'll at least have stuff to talk about.
Primer.
Yes. Well, exactly. And then after that, we're going to continue on with British comedy drama films like Snatch. So anything else for tonight's little show?
I can't. Did you see what Rainn Wilson is doing these days?
Yeah, I'm kind of wanting to see that show.
I know, me too.
It intrigues me.
Yeah, I'm curious.
Because he's got such an unlikable face, but he's pretty good in everything I've seen him in.
Yeah, no, he's got good acting. I just don't know how, I mean, it's hard to see him. The Office really typecast him.
Well, and like...
In roles that he was already typecast in to begin with.
Well, yeah, exactly.
He's played the same character, I mean, countless times.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what he does with this. Okay, well, thank you very much. Next week, The World Ends. Or something.
Yep.
Yeah, so...
All right.
So you, I don't know if you noticed, but it was like the strawberry cornetto symbolizing the blood in the first movie, and this was the blue cornetto symbolizing the police.
Oh, no, I didn't get that.
And the next one, the green cornetto. But we'll get there.
All right.
Until next week.
All right.
The most important tool in your toolbox is your notepad. I'm just saying.
And here, I thought I was just going to go with a brain freeze reference.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I just, if you just put all of the female PC, her little saucy jokes, followed by the mumbler guy, like when she's like, oh, I'd like to have an evening gobble. He's like, Cox.
Yeah, I know. That was a great running gag.
Yeah, it's fun.
But there wasn't as much subtlety, there wasn't a lot of subtlety in this film, either.
Oh, no, not at all. Nothing subtle about this.
Yeah.
We didn't even talk about the scene in the supermarket where the Butcher Brothers have this endless supply of knives that they throw.
No, the supermarket scene was hilarious because they're all, you know, because one of the Andes boys ends up with, you know, what does he say? It's the sauce all over his face. And it looked horror-esque. It was horror film-esque, and he's just like, it's just Romesco sauce or whatever.
Yes, Romesco. Yes.
Just hilarious. And like, and then the shopping carts down the aisle, and so.
Oh yeah, funny stuff.
And by the way, the interview is now available on Netflix.
Oh yeah, I'll have to watch it. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, because I've heard it's kind of funny. I mean, if you don't expect a lot.
I don't think I could expect less.
Well,
I mean, I've got pretty low expectations, but and I like Seth Rogen and I like James Franco, but I have a hard time with movies like this. So we'll see.
Yeah, see, I think Seth Rogen is fine, and I don't particularly like James Franco at all. So we'll see. But you know, for free, since now I have a much bigger cap, I can watch it streaming.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah,
excellent.
So, okay, well, more next week. All right. Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on our new voicemail account to leave voice messages. Or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts. Dial it already.